Here we go again. We have a journey into the archetypal emotions with Anita Green. But I have some wonderful announcements before. I'm Eric Lorenz, the president of our little association.
You can't hear
me. I can hear me. I'm the president of our Western Mass Young Association. Dan Grunwald is our webmaster. Thank you. Carol Beauvais is very Carol.
Hi.
Carol Beauvais is our community person. Sarah Green is on our board, and Judy Hall is on our board too. She's not here tonight. So welcome and thank you for coming. We ask that you donate $10 if you can. If you can't, that's fine. We don't want to leave anybody out, but please, that's how we run our website and all those things that make us run. So we appreciate your donation, and it also helps us to be more of a community when we're all chipping in. There's also an email list to please sign up if you want to get our email. And write clearly, very clearly, because sometimes like we get at home and Dan goes, who's this? I don't know who this is. All right, we're going to be recording tonight, actually doing a video, and we'll get it on our website. We have an archive so that you can listen or watch. We're doing more videos, which is great. And if we're talking and you're saying something that you don't want to have recorded, please stop recording and we'll do that for you. Okay? We don't take a break tonight because, well, I won't go into that. But there is a bathroom right here that says men, but anybody can use it, so just sneak out and come back in at your convenience. And afterwards, we're going to the Mosaic Cafe as usual for a salon where we all sit around and talk and have more conversations. So please come. It's really kind of fun. That's the Mosaic on Masonic Street. Okay. So we have several things coming up which are really neat. And we're looking for people to take the flyers out into the hill towns because we don't get out there. So please, if you are in a hill town, please grab a flyer or two. There are four events coming up. So we really, really appreciate that because that's a way to get the word out. And the one I did on Dionysian is we're trying to figure out how to download it onto YouTube, so that should be on our archive soon. And the next one that we're going to be doing is Sarah is going to do a workshop. Sarah Green is going to do a workshop on the shadow. So you want to say a few words about that? When and where and what?
Yeah. Those of you who are interested, there's a sign-up sheet over there, and also if you pick up one of the flyers, you can call my home phone and leave a message. Somebody called about 2 days ago and we lost the message. It was a woman's voice. If you're here tonight and you called 2 days ago, let us know who you are. I'd like to read a little blurb because I think it captures what I'm hoping to do. The most difficult aspect of becoming a whole person psychologically, that is, becoming authentic and real, requires an honest and often painful engagement with disowned and split off parts of our personality. We cannot grow into our full potential unless we are willing to make such an effort. This seminar will explore the ways and means for just such a transformation. And this seminar is going to be Saturday, February 21, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. with an hour or so for lunch. It's in Seeley Hall where we are. It's room 105, the other end of the hall. And the suggested contribution is $30, but give what you can. Everybody is welcome. So hopefully some of you will sign up on the sheet there, and we'll have shadows up.
Oh boy. So this is the flyer. So if you want to take a couple of those somewhere, that'd be great. Then our next lecture is the first Friday next month. It's always the first Friday from 7 to 9 here. And it's by Sarah Jackson, who's an analyst in Great Barrington. And she is an artist as well as an analyst. And she did her thesis on art and all. So it's called Regarding Images, What Visual Art Can Teach Us. So that should be really interesting. And then we have a wonderful new thing coming after that. Ellen Tech, where are you? Ellen Tech is a docent at the George Walter Vincent Smith Art Museum in Springfield. And she spent a lot of time in Rome and studying the gods and goddesses. And they happen to have a wonderful collection of gods and goddesses from Greece. And so we're going to have a field trip from one, this is after the lecture, not after the lecture, a couple weeks. On Sunday from 1:30 to 3, Ellen will take us through the exhibit and talk a little bit about the gods and goddesses right there in stone. And on the 22nd of February, and then hopefully we will have an analyst there and who will talk a little bit with her and you about what these archetypes are about in our life today. Okay, and this is for the images for the lecture, and we thought it would be nice to have a museum thing after a lecture on images. And this is the flyer for the museum. Okay, not so much going on here, we don't know what to do. Okay, the last thing is, by request of many people, we're doing another book discussion group on Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which is Jung's autobiography. And it's one of the best ways to get introduced to Jung. And we did this last year, right?
So,
yeah, last year. And I just want to mention that Rebecca Odegaard has helped organize this and is going to be there too. Yeah. And I'll be there periodically.
We did this last year. Many people signed up to had to go on the waiting list because we filled. I think Thayer sparked this off by recommending that all of us who are interested in Jung read Memories, Dreams, Reflections. We're going to meet weekly for those of you who didn't get in last time or people who are interested now on Thursday evening, 7 to 9, starting February 26th at my house around the fire. I facilitate it. The way I do it is we have assigned readings for each meeting. We sit in a circle around the fire, BYOB, and each person has 5 minutes to talk about what was important to them. And okay, I could go on, but we need to hear Anita. Anyway,
go ahead.
It was wonderful. Very personal around what is important to you in your life from the reading, and also applying it to our historical time. Okay.
And this is the flyer for that. So, and I just want to mention one.
And then we have an hour discussion.
So one more little thing. If anybody is interested, the Boston Institute has an auditor program that you can take courses there without necessarily training to be an analyst. Of course, if you want to train to be an analyst, you're very welcome to do that. But if anybody's interested in auditing, any one of us analysts can talk to you about that, right? So I'm going to introduce Anita Green, one of our analysts who's been here for a long time, one of our senior analysts. And she's going to be talking about archetypal affects. We've waited a year for this lecture. What happened last year?
Snowed out.
Snowed out.
No, I was sick last year.
Oh, that's right.
The year before, I think it was snowed out. So it's been a while. A shame that you want to reveal itself.
Right. Need I say more? Anita, as you can read, is an analyst and has been an analyst for a long time. I think I just want to say for me, Anita has really embodied. She's also a Rubenfeld synergist, which is a body method, and she has really gone through the process, inner process, so she really speaks from her inner experience when she speaks. So welcome, Anita.
Thank you, Erica. You people must be all be shame-based, because I can't imagine why you come out on such a cold night. Anyway, I think I should say a little bit about my credentials here. I have a PhD in psychoanalysis, but also a PhD in shame from experience. I grew up in a shame-based family, so I have all the credentials to speak about this matter. My mother's favorite phrase, can everyone hear me back there? Because I can project my voice. I grew up in an era when there were no microphones, actually. Anyway, let me know by raising your hands if my voice drops, which it does sometimes. Anyway, I wore black, mostly, because in a shame-based person, you sort of want to black out when necessary. I brought a scarf so I could cover my face if I need to. Once you've been a shame-based person, you kind of court shame, you know how it is. So, anyway, I came prepared. I feel very exposed up here, which is what a shame-based person fears most, is exposure. Now, my mother's dictum, again, I'll say, what will the neighbors think? That was her modus for life. So you were supposed to keep a kind of persona going that reflected well on my mother as a good mother. And she had a good family, you know. She lived a lot through her children. And when we did well, that was okay, but when we did poorly, we shamed her badly more than we probably shamed ourselves. Anyway, I will tell one story about me. Often I say it's one of my patients, but it really is me. It happened in second grade. And, well, back then I had golden blonde hair and looked a bit like Shirley Temple. I didn't have the dimple here, but I had golden hair, and my mother would do my hair up on rags, the same number of curls that Shirley Temple had. So I imagine in second grade, this girl whose name I blocked out for a long time, thought I was easy game, I think. And she may have been a bit envious of me because I was kind of cute. One day, and she did, she tripped me up. She would pull my curls when I was sitting in a chair. She would do all sorts of things to get my goat. And one day, as I was putting my coat on to go out to recess, I stood right next to her, and I looked at her, and with all the sense of my being, I said, I hate you. Oh, it felt so good. And it was probably was one of the first times that I expressed myself and felt my whole body was saying it at the same time. Unfortunately, my second grade teacher was standing behind me. And she said, Anita, I think you better stay in for recess. We need to have a talk. So I did. And she said, how could you say something like that? I don't think you know what hate is, do you? Of course, I knew what hate was, and I meant every word of it. So when everyone came back for recess, she put me in front of the room, stood me up there, and until I apologized to this particular girl, I was going to have to stand there the whole class. I don't know what happened to me, but some honorary part of me just stood there. I would not give in. But finally I realized if I didn't make some effort at some kind of a weak apology, I would have to stand there for the rest of the class. So I did. And this girl was so pleased that I was getting shamed in front of everybody. So I sat down, and then I walked home after school. No way was I going to tell my mother about this, because she would have sent me to my room and punished me and been very, very embarrassed by the action of her daughter. However, the teacher had called my mother before I got home. And so when I came in, I knew right away what had happened. And my mother said, how could you do that? No way was she interested in my story or what happened or anything of that sort. And I was sent up to my room without supper because I had shamed her. And I had no one to talk to about it because it had felt so good to say exactly how I felt. Other times, my mother, let me give you a couple of little examples. I took piano lessons from about 5 years on, and often I would be asked to play for the parent teachers associations or a group of teachers and parents. And so I would go in the afternoon, and once when I did that, I got started on the wrong notes, and it was terrible. And my mother was right in the first row saying, "That's terrible, Anita, that's terrible, that's terrible, that's terrible." And I got through it. And the second piece, I did very well, much better than I thought I would do. And I stood up and took a bow, and I could see some of the mothers were really clapping as though they didn't want me to think that I had made a dreadful mistake. My mother wasn't clapping, and of course I got it when I got home. Another time, I was involved in a contest, and I did what I usually do. I played the piano. Others acted a little skit or did something like that. And I won first prize. And then I was sitting behind a couple of the mothers. They knew I was sitting there. And they said, "You know, I think Anita got first prize because the judge was a good friend of her mother's." I was shamed several times because I felt so good about winning, you know, something that I had done. And because I thought it might be true. I thought it probably was true, actually. So those just give you an example of why I have a PhD in children. Anyway. Now, I want to give some credit to Dan over here, who's our tech guy, Dan Grunwald. He always picks out the images that you will see on the computer when you look up what's coming next. And they're perfect. This is more like disgust. Contempt's a little more elegant. But it's very hard to get a face when you look up to find faces with shame, because they're always trying to hide their face. They want to be covered. As a matter of fact, they want to sink down into the earth and disappear. So thank you very much, Dan. So I thought I'd have it as my cover piece. Now, I think it was about 3 years ago, or maybe two, I can't remember, when I did something on archetypal affects. And let me just... Oh, I included that just to remind us that we're all animals. And I don't know what happens when someday he realizes he's not a puppy dog, a pug or whatever, but anyway. Jung, way back in 1907, through his work with the word association test, realized, he said, the essential basis of our personality is affectivity. Thought and action are, as it were, only symptoms of affectivity. In other words, Jung regarded affects as the primary motivating force of the psyche, as well as its source of imagery. Very often he'd get caught up in the ultraviolet end of the continuum, the more symbolic spiritual end of the mind-body continuum, rather than the good old infrared, more instinctual whole of the mind-body continuum. Then in 1912, you can meet that. It's highly probable that the psyche and physical are not two independent parallel processes, but are essentially connected through reciprocal action. I mean, he knew that body and psyche, and down here, the separation of psychology from the basic assumptions of biology is purely artificial because the human psyche lives in indissoluble union with the body. So he knew that body and psyche were one. And some of my work way back when I was in training was to include body work within the analytical session. And I trained with a woman, maybe some of you know, of Alana Rubenfeld. And I'm also a Rubenfeld synergist, besides being a Jungian analyst. An interesting combination, because it just wasn't done. You weren't supposed to touch patients, you know. I mean, you might arouse something in the mind. I don't know. Now, in the third one down, he got involved in the vision seminars. And he himself was swinging way out into the symbolic realm. So he thought, I think, this is written to himself as well as to others. And, you know, once you move into the symbolic mystery, nothing can come of it. And he was really writing this to himself. Unless it's been associated with the earth, unless it's happened when the individual was in the body. Otherwise, and I love this, you were not there when it happened. So, whatever you experience outside the body in a dream is not experienced unless you take it into the body, because the body means the very present moment, the here and now. So I just show that to you to show that Jung himself was very prescient way, way back in terms of the oneness of the body and the spirit. So let me take you to a few things that, and I could have picked hundreds of these, more recent neuroscience research. Why don't I won't read all of Daniel Stern's, except the first sentence, the emotion serves as a central organizing process within the brain. I mean, that's what they are finding with all the infant research now. So just read that for a moment. As I say, I could have put many other people up here who are finding the same thing. And it's the right side of the brain, which is really turned on at birth, and the limbic brain also. The cognitive sphere doesn't come on until much later. And then Alan Shore says, affective processes appear to be at the core of the self. Antonio Damasio, he says that it's the emotional that gives the infant and the toddler a strong enough foundation to stand on so that they can develop their minds and intelligence. And I want to say that no matter what you turn out to be, a thinking type, maybe a feeling type, an intuitive type, or maybe a more sensate type, we all start out life as very experience-dependent, embodied, emotional beings trying to relate to other embodied emotional beings, our mothers, our fathers, our family, and that this is the important way we are shaped and formed. And then I included this marvelous book, which is real old now, A General Theory of Love, which, you know, when I have been in analysis or people come to me, we're not having just a pale conversation. We're in a somatic state of relatedness. And that's very, very important. Okay. I just wanted to include that again. Now, these gorgeous people. I'll leave that on for a while and you can soak it in. Actually, there's an empty chair waiting for you. I plan to go there too. We don't know what will happen, because sometimes when you talk about these things, you get infected and polluted also. So we'll see what happens. Even the dog seems welcoming them. Look at their eyes. Very often when you're a shame-based person, it feels like the world is all of eyes looking at you. Believe me, they are very well-versed in finding out how you fall short or don't measure up. They're very good at gossip, as you can see, so it'll be all over the internet before you know it. And it takes some courage to go and sit there, I think. Anyway. I invite you to the table of disgust, shame, and exposure. Okay. I think I'll leave that on for a while so you can just have a sense of what a lovely group of people they are and how welcoming they are. Let me just say, I think there's a big difference between guilt and shame, and I think I need to lay that out first. Freud used guilt and shame interchangeably. It was all around the Oedipal dynamic and the development of the superego. Now, I was told by someone, I can't remember who now, that there wasn't a single reference to shame in the index of Jung's collected works. So I looked it up myself. I found a couple, but when I looked, I could see that the woman was right, because he was quoting something Freud had said about guilt and shame. And at that point in their relationship, at least he tried to believe everything Freud told him about sexuality and the importance of it. I mean, it is important, but it wasn't the only thing for Jung. Anyway, sometimes they get intermixed with each other when we're very small, but I find that a guilt feeling, as far as I'm concerned, and I'll throw it open to you, is usually I've hurt somebody or done an injury or something of that sort. In inappropriate words or anger or emotion. Now, I can always apologize. I can always repair that in some way. For example, I remember in my rush to slide down the slide before recess was over, I did hurt a classmate of mine. Even I knew the difference between guilt and shame back then. I took her a cookie the next day. I didn't exactly apologize, but I handed her the cookie and she knew exactly what I was saying. And we stayed with each other and we became good friends after that. Let me say first that in the Lord's Prayer, there are two versions. One says, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." And the other says, "Forgive us our debts and our debtors." So the Lord's Prayer in its two versions takes care of the two kinds of sin. Sin of commission and the sin of omission. I think the sins of omission are what bother, at least they bother me as I get older, the most. And you can feel guilty about omission, especially with a friend who needs you or someone that you feel you should have called on, for example. And so you can begin to feel shame on top of the guilt also. So they get kind of intermingled with each other at times. But shame, it seems, more happens to you. You don't have too much to do about it. I remember a middle-aged woman. Can you hear me back there okay? Okay. Well, I'm just wondering if a microphone might help a bit here. Then I wouldn't... Well, we'll see. Anyway, she remembered something that happened when she was 4 years old. And her parents had invited friends over for dinner. And they were sitting in the living room, and the mother was out checking on the dinner's progress. And then the friends started talking to the little girl and asking her what she was doing, and she told them. And she said, well, I learned to do somersaults today. So she did somersaults, and she did other things, and she played around, and they were having such a good time. And her mother came in and noticed that there was a split in her pajamas, so that people were seeing her nether regions, her private parts. And the mother was so embarrassed that she sent that four-year-old child up to her room and slammed the door. I doubt that the friends cared. I mean, at 4 years old, you've got kind of a cute bottom anyway. Anyhow, I feel that guilt we can make some kind of reparation for or ask for forgiveness. But with shame, it often happens to us. And we're confused. We don't quite understand what's going on. Because it was such fun, you know, that particular time. Usually, it's pleasurable, it's fun, but it's shameful for the parent. Now, Eric Erickson, in his stages of development, called the anal stage of development autonomy versus shame and doubt. Now, that's what's happened to me, because my mother insisted that I learn how to use the potty before I was developmentally ready to. My instincts weren't up to working as she wanted them to. So I was put on the pot at the same time every day, but I couldn't come forth, you know. And the power struggles that we had, and the fact that what she did was make me constipated a lot of the time, where if I'd just gone when I needed to, it would have been fine. I became utterly ashamed of my eliminatory process. And in school, I never wanted to go to the girls' room. I had to wait till I got home, so I held everything in, even pee. Even though once in a while I would go to the girls' room, and if someone was in there, I tried to be so quiet so she wouldn't hear the urine hitting the water in the pot. And so I internalized my mother's own shame of her own body, is what I did. So I ended up with a lot of doubt and shame about myself. Now, that's not true with my first grandson, Jamie. We were sitting up in New Hampshire at our home up there in the summer, and having a drink, I think, before dinner. He came in just swaggering in. He was looking so pleased with himself, and he announced to us that he had learned to drop a turd in the right place in the pot. And before he flushed it down, he wanted us to come and see it. You remember that. Which some of us did, and praised him for it. So I can't imagine that this guy was going to have any problems with shame and doubt later on. I mean, this is one of the first gifts we give to the parents, you know. And if it can be given freely, it means that we have a better sense of ourselves, that we can accomplish something. If it's a fight all the way and we internalize shame around the private parts, it's another matter altogether. Now, shame crushes sense of self. And there's no repairing it in the way that you can if you hurt somebody, or you're trying to repair something you did. Let's see. There's an essential devaluation of who you are. And your whole sense of self is crushed. Now, for a shame-based person, exposure is the worst thing that can happen. I never felt very guilty, if I felt any guilt at all, for surreptitiously sneaking around the house and stealing things that I needed. No, no guilt at all. But when I was found at times with my proverbial hand in the proverbial cookie jar, that was a terrible feeling, to be found out, to be exposed. And although I have dealt with this in many ways so that I do not feel that kind of shame anymore, still, every once in a while, it hits me. And it's taken me a long time to feel, it's been a long journey analytically, because of my internalization of the body as a bad thing. When I first heard, and you know, you could keep kids really innocent back then. There was no TV, you know. I listened to the radio, but you know, it was. I was absolutely appalled and disgusted, and when I learned what sex was all about, and I said, well, that's never going to happen to me. And after 64 years of marriage, I can say I've changed my mind. Anyway, let me go on here. Let's see. One thing I said in the blurb was that it took many years until one of my colleagues, Lewis Stewart, gathered all of what Jung had written about affect. He never differentiated, he never really worked that out as he did many other things in the collected works. As a matter of fact, he would tell some of his women patients, perhaps they were closer to feelings, that someone else was going to have to approach the psyche through the emotional wing of it. So Lewis Stewart, when he wrote about the affects, he came up with four universal archetypal affects, and I dealt with them and didn't have enough time for shame, so you're getting all the shame in one bunch right tonight. We dealt with fear. You can't be human if you don't have fear. You wouldn't have escaped the predator if you didn't run away or do something to kill it. Every time one is born, there's sadness moving into grief. There's loss that we all deal with as human beings, grief. There's anger. Anger is a very necessary part of our psyches. It helps to give us boundaries, for one thing. When a child can say no, they really feel they've come to some kind of power in the family. And they will say no even though they really want to do something because it feels so good to say no, just like it felt so great to say, I hate you. Anyway, that particular experience, to go back to it, kept my feelings rather hidden for quite a number of years. Now, what Lewis Stewart did with contempt's always been considered separately, disgust and contempt, and shame, humiliation separately. He put them together. He said they were a bipolar affect. depending on whether you were on the giving end or the receiving end. That both had to do with alienation and rejection. Let me show you why my experience of it in the clinical area is that it's a bipolar affect. Let me give you a couple of examples here. A woman came to me, middle-aged, and she was telling me about a shameful incident that had happened the day before she came into the session. And then sometimes I work with someone in the same session on my massage table doing some body work, simple releases of tension and so forth. And I had my hand very close to her belly. And she said to me, "I don't know why how you can stand putting your hand there." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, it's like a swamp, and then I can't get out of it." And she said, "No, it's more like a sewer." And then she thought a moment and said, "I think it's where I put everything that hurt me, everything that I couldn't handle. I just stuff it in there and put the lid over it." I said, "Oh, that's interesting. Well, since now we found out where all those things are, why don't you go down there for a while? I have people talk to various parts of their body, too, as well as addressing a dream character, for example." So she said, "Well, I don't know that I can." And I said, "Well, let's take a moment and see." She said, "It smells so bad. It's disgusting." So I waited a few more moments. I still had my hand there. And she said, Oh, she said, "That's the feeling I get when I feel so worthless." So she got to the shame underneath everything. And this was a shame-based person coming out of a shame family. Now, she was a very lonely woman, and when I was in my fix-it mode, I would suggest possible things that she could do, to help herself out in the world. And it turns out that most every community or everything that I suggested or that she came up with didn't meet her standards. Most of the people there didn't have her education. They weren't, in some sense, as a good quality of character as she was. So hidden somewhere in this belly sewer place was also a grandiose, compensatory kind of energy that made her feel, in many ways, superior from other people. So that's one case. Now, in another case, a man in his mid-30s described to me a mother who pridefully inflated her son's talents and then subtly undercut them when he failed to live up to her grandiose expectations. He had a wonderful acting voice and singing voice at a rather early age, but at some production, he couldn't remember his lines, and he became tongue-tied, and he was so shamed, and his mother was even more shamed and got after him afterwards. He had a great athletic ability, true athletic ability, and when scouts would come and watch him toss a baseball in high school, he would do badly. And a career in professional sports was undermined by his internalized perfectionist standards that were constantly called into question by imagined slights and less than supportive remarks from a coach. I mean, it was like the coach would have to be like the loving father who praised him all the time for him to realize his athletic prowess. So, when he worked with me, he finally did some of the things. He was too old to go back to baseball, but he found other things. He took up boxing, and that was an incredible way that he learned to get out there. And of course, he didn't have a parent anymore that was telling him he was terrible. And inside him, he had problems with authority at the workplace. And several of his bosses, and several times he was fired, you know, he thought were stupid, were below him. So there was also within him a compensatory energy place that felt superior to many, many others. So when someone approaches you with more contempt, it's a little different story. I was working with one man who came to see me because he wanted to separate from his father. His father was a very well-known physician and wanted his son to follow in the footsteps and be a physician himself. Well, the son was completely another typology from the father. He was into music. He played in a band. He wanted to go to music school. And actually, he did very well. But he came to me because supposedly he wanted to be able to stand against this father with more sense of himself and not be shamed somehow to going to the medical school that his father wanted him to attend. So, let me see here. Got it all written down. We started our work. He was primarily a feeling type with a thinking type father. And he started bringing in dreams. Sometimes I get this from dreams, as well as working with the body. He brought in a dream of a medieval king spitting on a subject for disobeying him. In another, the dreamer himself was perched on a ledge above a town square spitting on passers-by. Now, that's the worst thing you can do to anybody in terms of shame, in terms of dismissing them, in terms of scorning them, is to spit on them. So I knew I was in for something, but I didn't know quite what. And then it was as though, because I was a woman, and his father often put down the mother. She was a feeling type and had none of the verbal capacity of the father. So I found myself being disdained. He made contemptuous remarks. He was completely unconscious he was doing this the whole time because he was there to get away from that sort of thing. But what his dreams were telling me and what he was doing to me was a complete identification with this father's contemptuous attitude toward most everything. Now, it has been found by many therapists and many people who work with contemptuous people that this is a major defense against feeling the shame underneath. It wasn't for a long time, really, and I had to really try to keep my seat. Because I am a shame-based person, he got to me in my worst place, and maybe some of you are therapists and know the power of an induced countertransference, which I was having. I found myself saying absolutely inept things about interpretations of dreams. I was becoming this stupid woman that he was determined to put down. Fortunately, I knew what was happening. So I could try to sit there and just be present no matter what. Until he could finally trust me a bit and begin to realize how much shame he had suffered from this father. His music helped him tremendously. And he became a very well-known musician. So, in a contemptuous person, and often that is the defense of males against shame. And Mary Ayers, who's written several wonderful books, one, Mother-Father Attachment, The Eyes of Shame, and now a new one.
Mother-Infant
Attachment, sorry. Thank you. And Psychoanalysis. And now one on masculine shame. And I do believe that men and women experience shame in different ways. Because a woman in our patriarchal culture, for what, thousands of years, has had to deal with being diminished, being scorned, a second-class citizen, they know much more about shame and how to handle it. A man can feel ashamed, can feel shame about feeling ashamed, because it means that there's something weak about him, or something not living up to a lot of these patriarchal standards that still hang around and hang around for men. This guy that came to me, this young man, couldn't express any tender feelings in the family. And when he cried, as a young kid does, his father would punish him and berate him. So there's still something out there, men, around the whole patriarchal system that doesn't allow for any weakness to be recognized. There, you ran into that in the military, didn't you? As I remember your saying, that what kept units together with all the fear around and the machine guns going off was shame that you wouldn't measure up and be there for a comrade. And that's what really, I think you said, linked you together in a very profound way. So, I think more men, at least in my practice, have been contemptuous than females have been. I think just because of how that patriarchal system hangs around more. So those are three examples of how this is a bipolar kind of affect. Now, I want to keep track of the time because I do have a very juicy case I want to have time for. Now, those of you who are therapists know also that this, when there's a highly idealized transference onto you, watch out. You hope that maybe it will break down slowly, so that you can still work with this person. But sometimes it breaks down immediately. I remember when I first went into training, and I believe me, as a trainee, sometimes your most difficult cases come when you're just starting. Fortunately, I had good supervision. But I had this woman brought in dreams, and which a beautiful woman changed into a very scaly, scary dragon, very armored. And I thought to myself, oh, I'm in for it. And I was, because the next time she came, she said, you know, I don't like working with you. You're a trainee, you're still in training. I can't afford to get a good analyst. And so every time she would come in and tell me what I had done wrong in the session before. So the reversal was very immediate. This woman also threw a vase of mine, missed me, and it smashed against the wall behind me. I think she wanted to show me how much in charge her own sense of self was. As she and I picked up the pieces. Later, she gave me a vase with an apology, of course. But she never quite got over the fact that she was working with someone without experience. Even though I had very, very good supervision, and I thought I did a pretty good job, she had the grace to write me later in life and say, you know, Anita, I did go to some of these other analysts, and they said exactly the same thing you did. So that was gracious of her, certainly. So, let me see where I want to go next. I'm going to keep track of that time. This is a big subject, as you can imagine. Let's take a look at some of the pictures I brought. Now, have you decided to come to the table?
No way.
Any questions so far? I know there's... Everyone experiences shame and humiliation at times, but they can recover from them. When you have had chronically exposed to a shame situation since you were a baby, it's a little different. There's a very core, it's much harder to deal with then in terms anyone, yeah.
You know, the musician that you've referenced, mm-hmm. whose father was a physician, do you think the father had been treated in that way and it was intergenerational coming?
That's a good question. I find that it is often intergenerational.
Yeah.
What has passed down comes down.
Yeah.
Yes. I don't know. I can't answer that question specifically.
Yeah, really data,
but it often is intergenerational. Yes. Yes. Anyone else? Yes.
I think shame requires a social...
No, go ahead.
Shame requires a social context. It doesn't happen in isolation.
That's right. And I will say more about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I was interested in the story, your personal stories when you began. And what I'm grappling with is to get a sense of, here's this child, that an experience happens to the child.
Mm-hmm.
And then... we label it shame. Does the child have that label within him or herself?
No. Not when they're really small, they don't. Let's take fear, for example, then I'll go to shame. We fear, and maybe we tremble. It's really scary. But that's not how it happens. First, we tremble. And then later on, we give a name to it, given whatever our culture or language happens to be. Shame, and I've seen it in my granddaughters, the when they're caught at something and exposed, the hiding, their whole body wants to disappear. They don't want to be there. They can't tolerate it. It's a little bit, sometimes the feeling of shame is hard to grasp, but sometimes it's like going down too fast in an elevator and losing your belly, you know, out. They don't understand the word and the conception of shame, but they surely can feel it. And Darwin and Tompkins, in his 3-volume book, I think learn more from their babies and infants than they did from all the other things that they did, because they saw in the baby's face everything that later on, I mean, they saw anger, they saw grief, weeping, they saw shame, and they saw it all in the musculature of the face, even before the baby obviously knew what was going on. So, we feel it in an embodied way first, then we finally have a concept of it later, much later on.
Or someone imputes it from the other.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. This lecture brings up a lot of issues. I was thinking of combat veterans are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and 20 beats of the day are killing themselves.
Yes,
killed,
I know.
Not suicide, then in actual combat. And I wonder how some of that might be shame-based, that they were ordered to do actions in a war setting that was against their morals and ethics, and it caused moral injury.
Yeah.
Or another word they call PTSD, but I like the term moral injury as opposed to PTSD. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think, you know, everything you say is so. I've dealt with a lot of trauma, but not in that specific case of veterans coming back. My daughter has somewhat. Part of the problem is it will bring up every other trauma they've ever had also. And there are ways in some of the behavioral cognitive ways of working to deal with that. What else did you want to comment on?
Well, I was just thinking in terms of maybe shame in that situation would be, I'm not sure, I'm not using the word positive.
Okay.
Anita?
You know?
Oh, hold on.
What I believe is being described, what came up for me is the words moral shame.
Oh, okay.
There's a violation of... for instance, in killing other human beings, that goes so deeply against our character, our cultural education. And so even though it is what one must do and one is trained to do, it is a violation of one's core. And I think that is a contribution, at least, to PTSD.
There's a movie out called Sniper, which I think treats it well. And the man was killed by some veteran he was trying to help at some kind of shooting range. Dreadful. But the only way he could handle it was think he was saving a lot of other lives. But of course, it caught up with him. I haven't seen the movie. I haven't read the book, so I don't know how he dealt with it. Yeah. Okay. This obviously is disgust. And these pictures come from a lot of Paul Ekman's work on unmasking the face. And. I mean, if you put your, disgust is distaste, but it's more than distaste. Something smells bad here, you know. Dismell, which we don't use anymore, a word that we don't use. So usually in disgust, it's a very visceral kind of feeling, and you want to get away from that which is yucky. Because in some way it's going to contaminate you, it's going to pollute you, it's going to poison you. And maybe some of that disgust that we experienced early on kept us from eating foods that were not good for us. I'm sure that may be where it started, at least one of the ways where it started. But this is the whole bodily... I mean, really. Put your face in that way and you say, get away from me. And, of course, that can change and turn on to people, too, we and them. I mean, you look at some of the... it amazes me every time I see Japanese playing baseball with Americans, because I remember the war when they were demonized. They were shown as monkeys, they were shown as murderers, as rapists, and all of that. And, we felt disgust. Do that to your enemy. And there's a... the guy who wrote this book, where I got this picture of the invitation, The Anatomy of Disgust, and he wrote very honestly at the beginning of it, he said, I'm going to become polluted with this stuff because I'm writing about it. So he knew that this would be part of the problem. And sometimes the body for us, with all its wonderful juiciness that keeps us alive and gives us pleasure, you know, I mean, blood, menstrual blood particularly, has been an object of disgust. And pus and sweat, all those things, you know, that are it maybe it's because we can't stand how close we are to animals that we look with disgust on some of these bodily functionings. So that is usually in disgust. The mouth is open, like, ooh, I wouldn't want. But you want to vomit it out, you know? Ooh, something smells really bad. It looks bad. It looks decaying. It looks like I want to get away completely from it, like a dump or something like that. Now, what happens? This is a more elegant contempt. But it comes out of that feeling, that bodily feeling of disgust. It's more elegant. Now, this looks a bit more like disgust, but that's changed into contempt. And, you know, contempt is a much more civilized way of looking down our nose at people. It's a much more literary. You can have sort of an ironic smile on your face, like, oh, you're hardly worth my even paying attention to, you know. So that, let's see some more faces. And contempt has an upright posture. Sometimes when I do body workshop, I have people walk around, and just to move the head up like this, and people will start walking, you know, like I'm superior than everyone else. And you know, they get into the feel of what that's like, because it is an upright kind of character here, and often the head is up a little bit. Let's look at some more here. This could be a school teacher, perhaps. Between disgust, I mean, her nose is wrinkled, her little nose is wrinkled. I forget where I got that. It may have been the New Yorker. Here's a New York lady in her whole body. Yeah. Hey, you took my parking place. How dare you? Whatever she's saying. Here's one. Very subtle, but it is contemptuous look. I don't know what he was thinking of. It was a big picture, took a half a page in several newspapers when he was still president. It may have been the last question of some journalist or reporter that he didn't want to answer, you know. Oh, come on now. I have no idea what he was thinking. But that is, that's a rather elegant kind of contemptuous look, actually.
Presidential contempt.
Yes, definitely. Let's see what's next here. Now, when I looked for pictures of shame, I did not get many faces. He's back. That was done for, I think, the some magazine made it quite a number of years ago. And the article was entitled In Defense of Shame. Now, let me say something in defense of shame. If we did not feel shame, we would no idea, we would not have clues of how to be in a social situation or in a family or what would be inappropriate in that moment to say. Shame helps us socially. It civilizes us. And as long as it's not severe, small doses of shame we all need, because it keeps us somewhat bound to the earth, somewhat humble. I mean, humiliation, humus, and earth, they're the same root. And you know, I do anyway. Don't you take some pleasure in some highfalutin politician that has fallen down and is exposed? You know, in the New York Times today, Brian Williams evidently said that he was in a helicopter and was shot down in Vietnam. And he wasn't. He was in the helicopter behind it. Someone found that out and exposed him. Now, men do this all the time. I think they feel the need to enhance somehow their male qualities or something. Other men have done that, enlarged upon their ability to be warriors or whatever. So I feel kind of a little sorry for him because he's getting excoriated on the internet. That I didn't have to deal with. That's what my children have to deal with. My grandchildren are having to deal with now. So, this is by Edward Munch, and it's called Puberty. It's not a terribly good reproduction. But when we come into puberty and our bodies change, it's when we can feel a lot of shame around. And you see, she's trying to hide. And her eyes, you can't see them too well, but they're sort of glassed over as though she's trying not her best to not even be there, not even be seen. And the whole body collapses inside. The musculature doesn't hold us up anymore. The blood vessels let go and allow that rosy hue of shame to come up through our bodies and into our face. When there's shame around in a session, I'm very good at picking it up because I feel a warmth flowing all through me. And I know someone is experiencing shame but not either unconscious of it or not expressing it. When the person owns up to some feeling, then it leaves me. So I know that it's what I'm carrying for them in the moment. Again, a finger like the one that Dan picked out, a finger pointing. You're no good. You know, shame has another good thing about it. I think it helps us keep private what we need to keep private. It takes us a while, when we're relating to someone, to trust enough to expose ourselves. And I think shame helps us not do that so quickly. And it's much more appropriate for who we are. So I think that it helps in terms of our private selves, as well as helping to socialize us and civilize us. Because a person that feels no shame, we call a sociopath. A person who feels no guilt, we also call a sociopath. With regards to shame, they don't have any empathic capacity to be inside another person in a way that could be helpful or could be present to that person. They do, with their intuitive sense, know how to manipulate the person, that's for sure. A psychopathic personality or a sociopathic personality does. So we all should be glad for small doses of shame, but not large ones, believe me. Anyway, now, I do want to bring in a case study that will show... oh, wait a minute. There's one other that's very important here. This is a painting by Masaccio, a 15th century Florentine. He is one of my favorite painters because that was the time when painters were beginning to paint people as they really were and learning how to work with body, you know? These bodies look, you know, someone in the 17th century, said, oh no, they can't have genitals showing. I guess he was a priest or a prude, but a painter. So someone came in and painted fig leaves all over the genital areas. And now they've cleaned it up and they found some of the colors are just gorgeous. here they are in their full glory as. And if what you don't see is the angel out. There's guilt, but the thing that consciousness brings primarily is shame. It's so interesting because is that a price we pay for more consciousness? Think about that for a minute. When, you know, God isn't stupid. He made the creatures and the animals. He put them in the garden. He told them they could do, the two humans, they could do anything they want, eat of anything they wanted. Why did he put that tree there? He said, and do not eat, the only thing you can't do is eat of that tree. Because I'm not sure whether he says in the Bible that'll make you aware of the difference between good and evil. But why put the tree there? Why create the serpent who seduces Eve into taking a bite of the apple? And then I think Eve wants more consciousness finally than Adam does. Anyway, it's Bluebeard-ish because Bluebeard tells all his wives, you can do anything you want in this castle, you can have anything you want, but don't go in that room. What is going to focus people's attention more than that? Obey me, you know, you can do anything you want, but not that. That focuses every eye on it. So, tell me, the angel is punishing them, sending them out, go. But what they're feeling is dreadful shame. And God knows that God himself knows when they've eaten of the apple of the tree of good and evil, because they know they're naked. Now that has something to do with the mores of the time, obviously, but they're no longer a part of that natural niche, that sort of uroboric womb-like place where everything is sort of unitary. And it's... When Prometheus steals fire, he pays a terrible price. And when humans work for more consciousness, sometimes there is a price to be paid for that. Prometheus happens to be bound to a rock with an eagle tearing apart his liver all day, and then it reconstitutes himself, and then he has, you know... The gods have prerogatives. Humans aren't supposed to have fire. That's what he stole from humans. And so there's a price, but there's a gift from God at the same time. And that's of more free will, consciousness. Now, what do you think? Did Masaccio get it right that the woman is hanging on to her body and the man is hiding his face? Does that feel right to all of you here who are women and men? The face of the woman is not hidden. It's filled with the agony of rejection. This is the ultra image here of alienation. They have been thrown out. He is to work hard in order to earn a living. She's to have pain in childbirth. They are now out in the world. And the world is kind of bare at first as they go out into it. What kinds of reaction is anyone having to this? I mean, this is to me the archetypal, the best archetypal image that I have found of the rejection, the alienation, not from just God, but from their own deepest souls in some way. Now they have to take responsibility for themselves.
You know, it's interesting to me. He looks like he's going to cry, and for a man to cry is a very shameful thing.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Anyone else have a reaction to that? Or?
Anita?
Yeah.
Paul Tillich. Mm-hmm. Philosopher, theologian, and Reinhold Niebuhr, both of whom were my teachers, talked about Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden because they had eaten of the apple and had the knowledge of good and evil, mm-hmm. that is the beginning of human history.
Okay. Mm-hmm. An experience and a knowledge of opposites, I think, is the root, is at the root of all consciousness, actually, too. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm just interested in people's thoughts about this being the masculine and the feminine. That was a good idea about the man who's ashamed to be seen crying. Is she ashamed of her body?
Yeah.
Would you say? Is that a more
that's
feminine
a thing that seems that way to me, yes. That seems that way.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to other people's comments on
yeah.
that.
I wasn't gonna comment on that.
Oh, you weren't.
Can I comment anyway?
Go ahead.
All right. I was thinking about this, you know, big story, but developmentally for each child to adolescence or something, there's a break in belonging of this kind of unconscious unity that happens. Mm-hmm. So it's like in the Parsifal story that Robert Johnson talks about, the felix culpa, which is like this descent from something that has to happen, like a necessary wound.
Okay.
So is the shame, you know, part of that moment?
Yes. Is shame part of that necessary moment, or is shame one of the prices we pay for greater consciousness? I think it is. Yeah.
It's a bounding thing. It's a bounding thing. It's a boundary of some sort. Overstepping.
An overstepping the boundary, yeah.
A reminder of our...
of our creatureliness?
Mm-hmm. And the danger of overstepping.
The danger of overstepping a boundary, yeah. Okay. Yeah?
I don't know, male and female there, but it looks like he doesn't want to see what he's done, and she doesn't want to be seen having done what he's done. So it seems like that's two halves. I don't know if that maps to male and female or not, but...
That's interesting. Say that again. He
doesn't want to see what he's done.
He doesn't want to see what he's done.
Where she doesn't want to be seen having done.
She doesn't want to be seen having done some of the things that she's done. You know, as I look at them, they're incapable of helping each other at this point. They are both separated. They are both struggling with whatever their feeling in the moment of alienation and rejection. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'll speak to the male-female dichotomy there. I think it behooves us, I think, to be cautious applying the male-female type that he shows there in terms of any kind of instinctive reaction of shame. Like, the woman is covering her body, the man is covering his face. We have many centuries of notion that the female body should be a shameful thing. So this very well may just be expressing that cultural conception, as opposed to any automatic desire of a woman, instinctive desire of a woman to cover her body out of shame.
Yeah.
A woman may well instinctively be as likely to cover her face.
Yes. So. I couldn't agree more with you, yes. One more and then we'll go on, yeah.
Well, connected to that, what she's covering is actually what gives life.
What gives life is what
breast,
she's covering.
So, like, that's like divine power then.
Yeah.
In this Christian context of the time. Mm-hmm. You can't have that.
I know, we're in a post-Christian area. I almost wonder, shame has been hidden for so long. It wasn't until the 1980s, I believe, that psychologists started writing about shame. And from there on, every year there were about 10 to 12 books on shame. They're still coming out. It's been the most hidden affect ever. And now it's out, and I think maybe because we're in a post-Christian era, we don't have a God there that has certain commandments or... And so maybe shame is the only way that keeps us at least minimally presentable to ourselves and to others. I mean, minimally civilized. When the great religion is dead and there's nothing much to take its place. I don't know, maybe that's crazy. I don't know. Yeah.
In Japan, shame is what controls society, opposed to guilt, which is what controls Western society.
Okay.
But in Japan, the worst condition is to be shamed, and you often notice that Japanese people will cover their mouth or their part of their face when they speak, especially if they're going to laugh or smile. The instinct is to cover that, not to show that. It's almost like covering the
covering their genitals, yeah.
But instead they cover the face. But that is what controls society.
Yes.
In the same way that guilt controls Western society.
I don't think guilt controls much of anything these days.
Not doing its job.
No, it's not doing its job. You're right. Look, I want to get into a woman that came to me that had what I call a early infusion of shame. Now, Mary Ayers makes the case in her book that shame is very primal and primitive, and it happens between the infant and the mother. And there is one little video that I want to show. Oh, wait a minute. Let me show you a couple of these. This is me and my grandson, Rowan, in sync. This is what it means. This was a wonderful moment. You can see every sense. You can't see my face, but I'm looking right at him. He's being contained. It's flesh to flesh, body to body, smell to smell. I'm singing him songs. He's cooing back. And all of a sudden, our eyes lock into each other. Now, if you've had that experience with an infant or a toddler, they have no defenses around their eyes yet. You know, they're very open. Did you know that infants have 100 million more neurons than the average adult does? Because they have to learn so much in those first 2 years before the cognitive brain comes on. Anyway, this is what it means to give the infant a sense of being. Because it is the mother. Winnicott got it right. He said that there is no such thing as an infant. You can't talk about an infant unless you talk about the mother's functioning and caretaking job of working with the infant. That the infant doesn't exist until the mother holds and looks and contains. Touch is very important, as is this look of the eyes. This child knows, because I'm carrying that image of him as a separate human being, this child knows that he is at this moment. And when, let me show you, let's see, this is a small video.
Babies this young are extremely responsive to the emotions and reactivity and the social interaction that they get from the world around them. This is something that we started studying 30, 40 years ago, when people didn't think that infants could engage in social interaction. In this still-face experiment, what the mother did was she sits down and she's playing with her baby, who's about a year of age. And she gives a greeting to the baby. The baby gives a greeting back to her. This baby starts pointing at different places in the world, and the mother's trying to engage her and play with her. They're working to coordinate their emotions and their intentions, what they want to do in the world. And that's really what the baby is used to. And then we ask the mother to not respond to the baby. The baby very quickly picks up on this, and then she uses all of her abilities to try and get the mother back. She smiles at the mother. She points, because she's used the mother vocabulary. She points at the mother. The baby puts both hands up in front of her and says, "What's happening?" She makes that screechy sound at the mother, like, come on, why aren't we doing this? Even in this 2 minutes, when they don't get the normal reaction, they react with negative emotions, they turn away, they feel the stress of it, they actually lose control of their posture because of the stress that they're experiencing.
Where the hell did you go?
The good is that normal stuff that goes on, that we all do with our kids. The bad is when something bad happens, but the infant can overcome it. After all, when you stop the still face, the mother and the baby start to play again. The ugly is when you don't give the child any chance to get back to the good. There's no reparation, and they're stuck in that really ugly scene.
Now, that's just 2 minutes. Obviously, the mother reconstitutes the play, but you can see the baby loses some muscular control, turns its head. This is the, say the mother's eye is depressed or blank. Let me show you a few eyes, actually. Some shame-based people think the world is all eyes. These are eyes, but here are three. Now, the one on the left, you might get to know, might see you as a human being. The one on the right is by Margaret, Renee Margaret, and it's called The False Mirror. And you can see, I don't know that you can see, this is an eye that it is somewhere else. It's not really looking at the child. And this is an incredible eye. Don't look at that one too much. It's the eye of one of Mary Eyre's patients, mothers. That cold, almost psychotic eye. That, what if that is all the baby sees, for example? There's no way that the baby can feel any kind of I am-ness at all with that kind of eye. But also an absent, you know. Sometimes I wonder, they're talking about something called two-dimensional bonding these days. You know, a mother will be nursing, and you know, this 8 to 10 inches from the eyes, and the mother's holding it, containing it, whether it's a bottle or whether it's the breast, that's the main eye contact that helps the baby to feel and sense himself or herself, that's the I am place. And sometimes I've seen mothers nursing their babies, and they're not looking. Their cell phone is over here, and they're catching up on all the things that they have to do on the cell phone, rather than being with that child. And so someone has been writing what they call two-dimensional bonding. I hope that's not going to happen, but you can see how important that I is. And to be in sync with the baby makes the baby feel, let's see, where's my card with Winnicott on it? Winnicott made a sort of a haiku or something like that, a little short poem. He said, when I look, and a baby looks around all the time, and I am seen, in other words, someone really sees them, then I exist. So Mary Eyre makes a case, which no one else has done, that the eye is so important to help the baby feel that I am-ness, you know, an I and a thou. This is Medusa with her snake. Her eyes will turn you to stone. Now that's another way a mother can look. Turning a child into a stone, a kind of rigid it an object rather than a subject. It's not an I thou. There's only one I, and that's the mother's. And the child tries to hold onto it, but there's no two-ness. It's an I-it. And it took Perseus with Athena's shield, because he couldn't look directly at her, in order to lop off her head. When her head is lopped off, that's when she is redeemed and then can be helpful. But it's almost like you have to lop off the head of those petrifying eyes, which make the child into an object. Yeah.
In nursing homes, sometimes people are fed in groups, mm-hmm. and often the CNA will be sitting with the three or four people around her, mm-hmm. and often as they feed each person, they don't look at them.
Uh-huh.
And it's tremendously effective.
It is.
Because when people are fed and they're not looked at, they have no impetus to eat because they don't have the sense that they are appreciated or valued or loved or
yes.
nourished
yes.
in any way.
I couldn't agree more. It is so important to look and to be present for others. I mean, the greatest gift we can give to our clients as therapists is to be as fully present as we can be, where that look is so important in order to transform the amount of shame that the client brings in. A client that is shame-based will have a tremendous desire to be seen, and you can feel that pull. You can also feel the pull back because it's too dangerous to be seen too much. So it's a pull-pull kind of situation. You can actually feel it in the transference-counter-transference situation. Yeah. I had a woman call her Laura if you want to hear a case. I'm open to more questions, or I can give you some case material of a woman who came to me who had a mother who was much too narcissistic, in other words, too needy herself, to really look at the baby as an other. It was an extension of the mother. And it's a rather juicy case, so if you get bored, signal and I'll have you ask more questions. Laura, a single woman in her mid-30s, whose earliest memory was being confined to her bed with her hands tied down by a mother who did not know how to deal with this most angry child. A child, or so it seemed to me, who was only vigorously expressing her rage at the constraints and restrictions of her upbringing. Father was absent, off to fighting in the World War II, her early childhood years. The role of this single mother, and I mean it's also the situation at the time, it's not just the mother's fault, obviously. The role of this single mother with several children was exacerbated by a period of extreme anxiety over a husband missing in action for several months. Laura remembers this time as a bottomless pit of a diffuse and pervasive apprehension without any felt boundaries of security. When Father did return, Laura turned to him for the love that she, and acceptance she had despaired from ever receiving from Mother, and was distraught at his subsequent abandonments whenever he left on business trips. One time she told me she just lay in front of the wheels of his car and he had to come out and actually pull her away. Now Father began to take out his frustrations with his wife on Laura. One game they played teased and humiliated her. He would entice her to trust him and place her hands in his. Then he would whack her hands hard. When she got upset enough and began to cry, he would comfort her. She learned that to be weak and timid was to get her parents' love. She cried easily, and her self-image was much like that of a whiny child clinging to mother's skirts. She presented herself as agreeable and compliant in the sessions. Her hidden, stubborn, passive-aggressive side had manifested in 10 years of alcoholism from age 20 to 30, in which she isolated herself in her room in the parental home, becoming an embarrassment to her parents. I think that's what she intended, actually. Finally, a woman therapist, not me, got her out of the house and into Alcoholics Anonymous. She came to me to work with issues around identity, femaleness, and possible professional directions for her life. She'd lost 10 years, obviously, when she could have been out there. So she had a lot to make up. Now, this short synopsis of her life story reveals how her ego strengthening and assertive energies were undermined by and subverted by parental dynamics. Her own subversion of herself through alcoholism delayed the normal development of the adolescent ego into adulthood. At the beginning of our therapeutic work, she brought in a dream in which she was holding a one-year-old baby boy in her arms. Suddenly, he flops over. He has a weak spine. No backbone. Spinelessness has always been a bodily mentor, a metaphor for lack of ego strength. Other dreams of weak knees and of a bloodied, severed legs clearly were indicating lack of a firm standpoint in her life. Usually, one does not use imaginal work or something Jung called active imagination with patients who exhibit such lacunae in ego development at such an early age. I have discovered that when the focus remains on what is happening in the body psyche, its tensions and affective states, by the touch techniques that I use, that this embodied form, I work with someone like this on the table, so that they always know my hands are there to provide a safe container. And this becomes a safe and effective way, I found, to release and relieve painful events, as well as encouraging that ego to begin a dialogical confrontation with those forces of the unconscious from which she must rest, resources for building a stronger sense of self. Now, a hollow feeling, when she brought in a dream with a hollow feeling early, for example, she related it to the lack of the concrete presence of mother. With my hands placed firmly but gently on her belly, I asked her what she might do to get mother's attention. Then I asked her to form an image of the mother and to get the mother's attention. She tried first, and she actually did it, some yelling and kicking on the table. When that failed, she realized, I have to cry. Then when she cries, the mother comes, but she is disgusted with my tears. She pays attention to me by shaming me for being so needy. So that's the only attention that she can get, by crying, but then mother is disgusted with that neediness part of her. So you can see how the shame is chronic and has grown over the years. Then she explained how much disgust, or she spoke to me about how much disgust she felt in her own body. And she realized that the mother, when she was only 3 or 4 years old, that's when the father was missing in action, wanted to lean on her. She was 3 and 4 years old. And I had to pull back because of all her mother's desperate needs. What about my needs? She thought. And we continued with our work. Laura understood at this point why her mother and she could not be close, that they each brought too many unconscious deprived places that they expected the other to fill. And that's weak. It's disgusting. So she had internalized all of that shame, and father also exacerbated the shame by the game he played, where he would slap her and then she would have to cry and he would comfort her. But it was as though she had to remain weak. She had to remain full of shame about herself in order to get any attention from these parents when she was growing up. Now, I'm so glad that with a person like this, I could do the body work. Because when in the therapy, when one really realizes the loss that they have endured all of these years, there's often a kind of rage. But after the rage, there's a real emptiness. Now, I think the body work helps with that. It helps to give the patient, the analysand, a sense that someone is there with her like her mother had not been. So it's kind of like it's not a redoing, but it's a new kind of place to be for her. And in that way, doesn't feel so empty or worthless. You have to be careful with some shame-oriented people of suicide, because they feel sometimes that's the only choice they have that isn't corrupted by parents in some way, that they still have a choice whether they will live or die. I could feel the disgust in Laura's body every time I touched her. Although she'd not been diagnosed with an eating disorder, her years of lonely drinking and passive-aggressive resistance to mother's attempts at a normal family life, including serving meals to her in her room, indicated to me an acute alienation from her own body self. Now, Freud says this first self is the body self, and I do believe that. And if there hasn't been that secure foundation made with the mother, I myself had to deal with a split-off body complex, and it took me quite a number of years to be able to settle down in my own body. It never happened with my own mother. Now, as she said, she was disgusted of herself because she became an embarrassment to the family. But she said, I was always an embarrassment to my mother, as I was. I had some kind of identity problem sometimes with this patient, I think. And I remember the contempt on her face and snide remarks, her mother's to her now, when I made bathroom noises, coughed too much, or had a snotty nose. I mean, the mother helped this child to really be disgusted with her own female body. My mother hated me for being sick and crying and taking up too much of her time. And as I said, father also humiliated her with his sadistic slapping games and teasing remarks about her own body as it developed in puberty, Laura's body. So Laura's ego-strengthening, self-assertive, independent energies were subverted by both her mother and father at every stage of growth. She learned that weakness and tears were the only ways to get to her parents and have their attention. Father's comforting arms and mother's concern laced with contemptuous remarks about her insatiable neediness. By the time Laura started work, with me, of course, and long before, she had already internalized such shame and loathing for her feminine body home that she was certain I would feel the same disgust when I worked with her. Of course, I didn't feel that. She was also upset on the days she thought I was tired expecting me to be drained as mother had been by her needy presence. So our work depended, like building up an experience of trust, both verbally and nonverbally. The early dream of that one-year-old baby with a floppy spine revealed how little she felt the strength of her own body or the strength of her own ego position. The consistency now of the table work, let's see where I'm at here, began to help her be able to experience more herself. What I was doing was kind of mirroring her on the somatic level that had never happened in her life. Laura exhibited some of the characteristics of a borderline personality, an unstable self-image, moving back and forth between the extreme polar opposites of her psyche, from a helpless, shame victim to a to sadistic self-loathing. I became either the all-good mother who read her stories and put her to bed, or the all-bad mother who was cold, withdrawn, and uncaring. With my hand on her body, we could explore and move in and out of these polar extremes in her psyche, struggling to find the middle ground on which she might stand. She brought in some dreams about a year later. In one dream, this was prognostically very hopeful, Laura kidnaps a baby from her mother's house and gets it out before mother sees it. In another, an older woman, whom she associated to me, pulls a baby fully out of a womb. The child can sit up straight and not flop. The child also seems to have permission to go back into the womb when needed. This dream reminds me of Mahler's separation rapprochement stage, in which the child assumes more independence from mother, but can always return for reassurance and supplies. So, tears came easily. Let me see, I want to... I think I worked with her about 5 or 6 years, actually. Direct anger was so unusual for her. She never thought she got angry, by the way. But she reluctantly admitted that she had been angry after one session when she came in the next time. The first time she'd expressed anger toward me, because I seemed to be taking a friend's side against her. I don't even remember, but I assumed that I had done that. I suggested she go down to her belly. At first she was confronted by dense blackness, then fiery red flames engulf her. In the midst of the flames sits a baby crying with rage. No one is paying any attention to it. Finally Laura picks it up, and the baby starts pounding on her face with its little fists, and she feels she must let the baby pound as much as it wants, since mother had restrained her hands and body when she was a baby. Enraging her and making her feel helpless. She didn't want that baby in her active imagination to feel helpless. In the session, she could also now hit a pillow with some conviction. She couldn't before. Now, Laura's split off repressed sides seemed to be represented by different ages of children in dreams. She would come, and they seemed to be growing up in terms of our therapeutic time together. An 8-year-old girl appeared in a dream who had been completely on her own, surviving by stealing money from a church collection plates. this was a real rebel. she was kind of angry and nasty, and this 8-year-old came over and punched Laura in the face in her active imagination. An amusing replay of the baby's pounding. Laura punched back. And the child, this was so opposite to her image of herself as a whiny child clutching mother's skirts. So in a way, we were letting little doses of shame out, almost making a kind of vaccine together, sort of a homeopathic protection against more dreadful feelings of shame. And her aggressive side that had been pressed for so long was beginning to come alive. So once someone makes steps forward, there's usually a regressive period. And it was disturbing to me, after several months of steady progress, I should have expected it, when Laura brought in a dream of climbing a high mountain and slipping off the icy road and falling down through endless snow that had no bottom and threatened to suffocate her. She seemed especially tired the day that she brought in the dream. I wondered if she were experiencing her progress as an endless and arduous climb up a mountain, never to reach the top and in constant danger of sliding off and sinking into oblivion. Her intractable belief that there was no solid ground or support underneath had come full circle again. At first she was terrified, and all of a sudden she started stamping her feet, and the snow began to collect underneath the feet until she had a firm enough place to stand on. I didn't suggest she do that. She just started to do that in her body. The first time she had done something for herself. What is that myth in India? I think the god stamps his feet and makes the firmament. I can't remember right now what it is, but there is a myth about that. So for the first time, she found a way to make a supportive place for her to stand. From that moment on, whenever she had a free fall or aggressive place we were in, we or she devised a place for her to become more active in the therapy and her outside life. She finally did get a job for herself. We moved, so I lost track of her. I don't know what's happened late in her life. But I was so glad that I was able. This woman had chronic case of shame, felt so badly and disgusted with herself. And I was so glad that I had a technique I could use where I could give her the sense of present moment containment and all that she was experiencing. I can't tell you where she is now or what she's doing, but this was an important watermark in her development. Yeah, go ahead.
In describing what you do with your hands somatically to give a person a sense of embodiment and of being enclosed,
yes.
What can you teach someone to do to and mm-hmm. for themselves mm-hmm. to replace your hands when you are not there?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. She did make a couple of friendships, which were good, and I don't know how much hugging there was or that sort of thing. It's almost as though you need an other. There are ways that she found to, I can't answer that question really, because I don't think I thought to give her ways to do that while she was with me. She did get into a movement, a yoga class, and I think Aikido, where there's movement with the bodies. But that's a good question. I don't know, except maybe hugging yourself. I find I need help, but exercise was one thing she started to take up. I think that helped tremendously. Begin to feel her body move underneath her. Anybody else? Over here? Oh, it is fine. Yes. One or two more questions, though, if people want. If not, yeah.
You talk about how she related to you initially, and how that was in terms of, you know, her ability to trust the therapy relationship.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'm getting.
Could you just describe how that was and how it evolved
for
her?
I thought I did in what I just read, but no, when she first came, we, and I saw what her dreams were showing, you know, that baby with the spineless, you know, flopping, that this was going to take quite a long time. And I try as best I can to be very physically present in a session, no matter what is going on. I mean, that's the way that I work. She was interested in doing body work. She had heard that I had done that. So that's one of the reasons she came to me. So we started that fairly soon, and that helped a great deal. You know, I've had training with these hands. It's interesting because one person said to me, you know, I've never experienced hands that don't require anything from me. And that's what you learn in the training, to give a touch that allows a lot of space for that human being to be who they are. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's time.
Thank you.